We are really, really grateful to be able to be here. I feel particularly humbled because I often am, aware of the thought that the unique situation that our church has to have so many men of God who are serving and active and invested and leading, that is like super rare and super unique, and I'm really grateful to be a woman in that kind of community. So thank you for who you guys are in general, in your homes and in this church family. It's awesome. So basically, our life, like a large portion of what we spend our time doing with our life is investing in the students, particularly of this church, so like middle through high school. And intentionally, like we're not like being their friend, although that is hopefully part of it. We are intentionally trying to guide them and coach them in their spiritual life. So every single interaction that we have with them as leaders and as staff, which there's a couple in here tonight, is pointed and intentional to try to maximize the spiritual benefit of that interaction. Mm-hmm. So it's really cool. Like over the course of the years that we've been doing youth ministry together, what we're going to share with you tonight is like a really wide field of data. Like it's not just like one kind of family, one kind of parent child. Because we know, like right now there's 4 adopted students in our youth group. There's a lot of parents that are living with a step parent, a lot of kids that are living with a step parent. So it's not like their biggest influence or their main father figure is even their biological dad. So it's not. These are not like. This pertains to one scenario.
Pretty much every sort of family situation, you know, single parents, the children are believers and the parents aren't believers. We have some kids who are in incredibly abusive, physically and emotionally abusive situations, and all range of people, students that will never speak to you about anything spiritual to ones who are like every second, they're like, come talk, you know. So we're not just—it's not just people that have opened up. It's just like tons and tons of different students.
Right. So we are. What we hope to share with you tonight are things that we truly, like, wholeheartedly believe are not gonna like. We're not gonna like try to, because obviously we are not. Our kids are not even 3 yet. So we are not coming to you from a perspective of experience. We don't know the road you're walking with your kids. But we have seen enough from like the sideline parent-child dynamics and things that just work, not even between parents and kids, but like things that work for us as staff, as people that are trying to like talk to teams. So there's some like overarching, I guess we'll call them helpful hints that are not meant to like tell you how to have a relationship, but how to maximize the things that like the benefit of what you're already doing with your kids or whoever's in your life that you're trying to impact.
Yeah, I mean, like, we have, like, an interesting perspective because it's, like, a side view, you know, for, like, seven years from 6th to 12th grade, we get to sort of watch a lot of students over a lot of time. And, you know, like, when it's your kids, you don't necessarily get to go back and start over with that information, but we can kind of take that, what we learn, and apply it to all the different students that are coming in. And like Abby said, I mean, we really do, we exist to help your students. We have about 100 students in our youth group between 6th and 12th grade on a weekly basis. This is a shameless plug because we believe that we have the best youth ministry on the planet. If we didn't, then I'm not sure why we would. If I didn't feel that way, I'm not sure why I would be here. We don't, and like Dad said, and he was kidding, we don't believe everything that students tell us. And what we don't want this to be, to feel like, is that we're here with like their compiled list of complaints about their dads. You know what I mean? Like all like the secret gripes that they've been sharing with us, and we're like, yeah, let's tell them. Okay, it is literally nothing to do with what we're about to say. All we want to do is just give some observations about how dads can help their kids grow. And some of these are ways that we see that in our opinion, from our perspective, are shortcomings in fathers. And some of them are just like ways that you can do things more effectively. And obviously, I think that some of these aren't just for dads. And a lot of you guys have students in 6th through 12th grade range. Some of you younger, some of you older. I don't know, is there anybody here that doesn't have any kids? Nope. Oh, yeah. These guys. So some of these are for dads. A lot of them, almost all of them, can be applied simply to all men. It's not even that much of a stretch to take what we're going to talk about and apply it to your wife relationship. You know, I mean, maybe not all of them. It could be a little weird. But what we're going to do is we basically have four is all we really want to do, four concepts. And the first one, I kind of want to dive right into it. And I don't know, I mean, I have never been to men's ministry before because whenever you guys are here, we're in the other building. And right now we are getting ready to do our helpful hints segment where we talk about things like how to, you know, navigate a flower shop or like how to save money for college and weird stuff like that. And then we go into our lesson. But we're over there, so we don't really know what you guys normally do. So, I mean, like, if anybody has any questions for us about what we talk about or, like, about what we do or just in general, I guess we'll do that at the end, you know?
Sure.
If you just want to call out in the middle, that's fine. Let's go for it. Wait a second. Just throw something. The first point that we want to talk about, and I think that this is a really big one, is this, okay? Dads need to understand effective encouragement. We see this as a really really important thing. Dads need to understand effective encouragement. And this is not because what I'm not saying is dads don't encourage or aren't encouraging. That is so not what I'm saying. But what we see is that I feel like the way that most men encourage is not necessarily very effective. It doesn't accomplish what you're trying to accomplish. And the way that to see this is that has anybody in here ever felt like in your own family, people were feeling like you were being ultra or too negative, and you're like, what are you talking about? I do say nice things. How do you be encouraging? You feel like you're being encouraging, but your family is feeling like you're not being encouraging. Like, what's the problem? We would say, I think one of the things that happens in men a lot of times, to be honest, and this is me also, is that we are not being very effective in the way we encourage. And so what we want to talk about is what effective encouragement looks like, because this is so powerful in the life of your students. And really, I think the best way to explain effective encouragement is through kind of comparing it to our relationship with God. In the Bible, there's basically a lot of promises that God gives to people, and theologically, they fall into two categories, and the words for those that we use are positional and conditional. Position and condition. Have you guys heard this before? Basically, what happens is there is a lot of promises that apply to all believers. It doesn't matter what you're acting like, because your identity, because you belong to God, because you've crossed from death to life, it is true that you go to heaven. It is true that God loves you. It is true that you're forgiven. All those things are positional promises. In other words, it's your identity, okay? It has nothing to do with what you do. So positional is your identity, and the other part is conditional, and conditional is easier to understand because a lot of promises like I'll bless you is not based on no matter what you do, I'll bless you, okay? It's on like, it's actions based. So if you, then I, you know what I mean? So if you obey me, he said to Israel, then I'll protect you. If you don't, I won't, okay? So that was based on what they did. So there's two kinds of promises, positional being like identity promises that never change for any reason. They're always true no matter what your behavior is. And conditional, which is like the ups and downs of the actual relationship. So you have identity and actions. And that's really important to understand because these same concepts apply to encouragement. We see a huge, imbalance in the kinds of encouragement that parents use, specifically dads. And it's usually weighted a lot toward actions-based encouragement. So if we put this in encouragement terms, you have identity encouragement, things that are always true no matter what you're feeling, no matter what they're doing, no matter how they're acting, and things that are encouragement based on their behavior. Okay? And what we see is nearly 100% of encouragement that comes between a dad and a child is actions-based encouragement. It's things like, you did well in your soccer game. You know, good job eating all your peas. It's kind of like where we are, you know what I mean? Thank you for being home in time for your curfew. You know, it's amazing you guys understand. Okay, actions-based encouragement is extremely, you know, it, it, I like your car. You know, that's even an encouragement, okay? So actions-based encouragement is very easy for us to understand. But this creates a big problem, okay? Because if there is only, or let's say even mostly, action-based encouragement between you and your child or your wife, that creates a lot of problems. A lot of problems. The first one is that it doesn't take that long before your relationship with your daughter or your relationship with your son or your relationship with your wife or your relationship with anyone who you're you know, applying this to becomes a works-based relationship. Works-based as in if you don't, it's never said. I mean, like, I hope that you would never say this. If it's never said, if you don't live up to my standard, then I, you know, don't feel the same way about you. That's never really said straight out, but a lot of times that is what is communicated if all you're encouraging are things that they are doing well. And in the process of saying nice things, you're actually reinforcing a really, really dangerous lie. And when relationships become works-based, they fall apart. They do with God, they do with people. If it ever becomes about performance, what we call performance acceptance, which really, honestly, this is kind of a big thing that I have had to work through with God, because I got to the point somehow of feeling this way toward God. When I do stuff for him, I feel good about my relationship with him. That is so dangerous. It's so dangerous, okay? Performance acceptance, the way we see it from dads, it really actually comes out a lot in things like sports. Because you're proud of them, and because you want them to feel like valuable in that, dads lavish sports-related encouragement. But what happens when they don't do good? It doesn't actually matter what you say at that point or how many times you say it's just a game or, you know, I still really love, you know, you did great. It doesn't matter because the message behind it has already been clear is that you like them because they do good in sports. You never said it one single time, but because of only giving works-based affirmation, that's the message that is read loud and clear. In things like work ethic, if you only encourage things like you did a good job at this, or you know, like manners and behavior type encouragement, if that's all it is, which are all really good things, it creates this imbalance. Where am I at? I have some other examples. Lost it. Oh, yeah, I think a lot of dads also do a lot of building up in the area of critical thinking. We really want our kids to be able to problem solve, you know, to be able to, like, think. I think that's one of the things that we look at students, as older people look at students and we say, nobody knows how to think anymore. You know, how do you think through stuff? And so a lot of dads put a lot of emphasis on encouraging the things that they see as far as critical thinking in their kids. But if it's only that, what happens is it will become, or already is, a works-based relationship between you and your child. And the long-term effects of that are probably, and we, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of you in here that would feel this way. It just becomes, it's just too much to try to always please them. And so it's just easier to not care anymore. And so a lot of kids, they just disconnect from their parents because they're stopped, it's too much pressure to try to always be winning affirmation. And a lot of men specifically walk away from their families and cut ties as far as influence is concerned because they're just tired of not measuring up. And you don't even have to say you're not measuring up. But if you encourage in a way that is so balanced on the action side, it speaks loud and clear, I care. You might never have actually thought this, but you accidentally communicated, I love you when, or I love you if. And that is so, so dangerous. That's where identity-based encouragement is so crucial. So we have two parts. You know, the actions-based, we have actually a good handle on that, but identity-based encouragement has to come first. It's by far the most important one, and it's the one that's more abstract, so we just miss it. Because if they make a great catch, it's in your mind, that was a great catch. okay? But this is something that you actually have to really work toward. Identity-based encouragement is so crucial. Identity encouragement equals encouraging things that are true no matter what you feel or what they do. They're like baseline. Same as like God loves us no matter what we do. It's like things that you that are true about you and your child or your wife or whoever, no matter what the circumstances or the feelings are. So here's some specific examples. And I said this on Sunday because honestly, these specific words would revolutionize so many relationships if they were heard more often. Things like, I'm glad you are my son. I love who you are. Just those little bit on the end changes it from the standard I love you to something more than that. It kind of penetrates the surface. I love who you are. I'm proud to have you as my daughter. I'm thankful that you're part of this family. Like, honestly, saying you belong here. You know, you're one of us. A lot of students don't feel like they fit in their own families because they don't hear that. Expressing confidence in anything that you can. And honestly, we know that in some students, even not even living with them, I would still say I would struggle to find something to encourage. And I don't mean that as like a, that's just the reality, okay? So it's not necessarily about being easy, but it's about finding those things that are identity encouragements. And this is, I mean, like, Abby will talk in a second about what this looks like specifically to be emotional support for your daughter. But for your son, emotional support is so crucial. And it looks like this. This is, it's just so, when you, if you do this, you will immediately see the results. It might be weirded out, and that's a good thing. Honestly, this is what all sons need. Straightforward, raw, uncut emotional love. And what that looks like is hand on the shoulder, eye contact, I'm really proud of you. And then not expecting any follow-up or response. Like, and that's it. I don't expect you to say anything. I'm not looking for a conversation. Done. That's all I wanted to say. And if that would happen more often, that would be such a powerful thing. And when your children know that they belong, because they're hearing it, by you actually saying, you belong. When they have that, then all of that other encouragement that you guys already do really well, it like becomes something that's actually effective. You know, it doesn't matter how much action encouragements you give. If there isn't identity encouragement, it will accomplish nothing. Or we were talking about it, it will accomplish, I think, less than nothing. To just say nice things about actions, if you don't have identity with it, it would probably be better if you didn't encourage at all. If without balance, one just becomes this underground
burden.
Yeah. Your children need emotional support from you. From you, like from you as the dad, not just from the family unit or not just from their mother. You know, they and it's an empowering thing to be able to say that. You know, we are in the position where I do get to take a middle schooler aside and say, I could not be happier that you are here. I like who you are. Let's go play, you know? And to see that, like, it, like, sinks in. It really does. And it would even go further if it was from you.
This idea of, like, giving approval to your kids in an emotional way, verbalizing that approval of their identity, the things that will never change about how you feel about them, is so crucial for your daughters in particular and for young women in particular. And the reason why is because women across the board, as a result of our fallen, sinful nature, like the way that God designed us was perfect and then sin got in there and twisted everything up. And one of the things that happened there is that women have a tendency to seek this approval from people where we should be secure in knowing that our value is only, like the only reason we have any value as humankind is because God chose to give us value. We didn't have it inherently. He just decided, you're valuable. I will pay a price for you. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason. So that's where our security as women should come from. We have such a hard time staying rooted in that. The most like mature, spiritually like wise women that I know still struggle to stay centered in that truth. So how much more are like, you know, 13-year-olds and 14-year-olds struggling to really know, okay, my worth, my value is because God gave it to me. So this is so essential for your daughters. The reason that it's dangerous, the really, really dangerous path that this leads for girls when they seek their affirmation, they seek their validation from people, is because it usually takes them to the same place. Like 9 out of 10 times, they end up looking for that from boys. You know this, but why? Why boys? The reason is because it is the easiest. It's the easiest and quickest way to achieve that feeling of validation. Because if they want someone to, well, okay, they know by now, if you have a daughter, she knows at this point, well, she's in middle school or higher, she's probably either just finding out or has already realized that she has a powerful sexuality. And she can choose to manipulate that just ever so slightly, and all of a sudden there's always someone there to take the bait, especially if they're like surrounded by people in like a public school who are not, you know, who are more than willing to take the bait. So once she discovers that, it's like, whoa, there's that validation. I feel approved of. I feel like someone wants me. So it's like they go right there because that's just the fastest and easiest way to get the feeling that they're desiring. So we have seen so many times girls, because we see them for a lot of times from sixth grade till they graduate. And that's a long time to see this progression play out. And we've seen it play out dozens of times, where it starts with just a little bit of like, oh, they came back to youth group this year, just a little like different, like a little more flirtatious or a little more promiscuous in the way that they dress. And by the time that they're a senior, they have gone places that they can't come back from. And they are involved, like deeply entrenched in sexual sin. And not always, but often, that starts with a search for approval.
Yeah.
That's where that road kind of begins. So we have, you know, so how many times in just the last year have we had parents or you know, girls confess that they've been sending, you know, nude pictures of themselves to boys and sexting and, you know, just being, like, undignified in the way that they are, like, carrying themselves and being so flirty to that point and just, like, lying, you know, sneaking around, all these things that they even know is a shame. This is like, okay, so this is a really grim reality. So to back it up a second, why is it so important if we as women, as these girls, are supposed to be finding that security in the Lord, why is it so essential that they be getting it from their dads? And the reason is because God has positioned fathers to be the mirror image, to be like an example in the context of an earthly relationship of how God loves his children. So fathers, and you all know this from your fathers, they will give us our first and strongest understanding of God, how he loves us and how he relates to us. So that's either something that students have to overcome, or it's something that sets them up to understand God in the right way. So for girls, this is so, so crucial that they be hearing things like, I'm proud to be your dad. You are so beautiful. I really like the person that you are. I'm so lucky to have you for my daughter. These are essential, especially for your girls, because they will safeguard them from trying to find and satisfy that feeling from other people. And it's safe for them to get it from you, because not only will that approval benefit your relationship with them, but it's also going to give them a correct image of God. So it's like, if they get that from anyone else, it's not healthy. But if you give it to them, even if they're going to you for it instead of God, it's still safe. Because they're going to learn about that God loves them, that God wants them in his family, that God desires a relationship with them. So you're teaching them the right image of God. They get that from you. And it keeps them from going down dark roads that have painful consequences for everybody.
Obviously, we realize that free will has its place. So it's not like if you say these magic words, it's going to happen. But this is like a lifestyle of saying these words. Really is like a strong protection for your daughters.
Right.
It really is.
And I know you've all probably heard
because it's funny because we see some girls who are like, why would I even want to go into sin? And others that are like, I desperately want to go into sin.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that probably the main difference, everybody can choose for themselves, probably the main difference is what Abby's saying right now. Because they have a strong and continual foundation of a man expressing admiration in the form of identity encouragement. Not like, you look nice today, mm-hmm. but like, who you are inside is my favorite thing ever. You know, that kind of thing. But like yeah. that really getting to the core.
Right. And so that's the end of the first point, basically. Giving your kids...
That means we're only a quarter of the way done.
We're really long-winded. I'm sorry.
You should see
we'll
it
try to go quicker.
Yeah.
But yeah, dads need to understand effective encouragement. So all of yeah. that like actions-based encouragement is still so valuable. It just can't be the main one. They have to have that steady, consistent like identity encouragement, and that keeps them grounded in that, and it keeps all the other encouragement from becoming some sort of like pressure.
Yeah.
So, okay, the second.
Can I just yeah. add something on that? And just like and just as kind of like a way to close that out, it's intentional on our part. Sometimes when we do intentional things, we expect kind of like a result. Maybe the best thing to do here is to not expect anything right there, anything back. No physical reaction or anything, because sometimes that can just bring sort of disappointment. Knowing that it's effective. And then just sort of letting it there is actually better, you know, than doing that to try to get something back from them, you know, to like elicit some response. It's just like, I don't need anything. Wow. It's enough for me just to say it, you know. So just like don't expect any response from those moments that you set up when you choose to say those words. Even just like, I mean, with guys specifically, sometimes it's better to do that in a time when it's not awkward after, because you're still like there in conversation, you know, just kind of like hit and run type thing. Anyway, sorry. Anyway. Yeah. Sure. I think that that sort of fits with the next one a little bit, the communication transition. But yeah, I mean, like, that is a good question. No. Like, specifically, I mean, if we know something is really valuable and you haven't done it, then that's your own fault. And I don't mean that, you know what I mean? But like, now's when you have to start that. If you can look ahead and think, I want a position in their life, or I want my daughters to stay strong, then the cost a lot of times is maybe having to do some backpedaling, you know? And, well, I mean, like, it sort of fits in the other ones, but I would say that, like, if you can just start saying this, and you just say it. I don't think it has to be, like, this big formal, I know I haven't said this very much to start. I think it's just to be like, hey, I just want you to know that I like having you as part of our family. You know?
I just want you to know that I love having you as part of our family.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Nice. No, and I mean, like, obviously, a large part of the reason that I am here now is because I did have a lot of affirmation in that way. You know, and like, remember, it's all tactical. All of this sort of blends together.
You can clarify it as you go.
Yeah, we'll clarify that.
Okay. So the second one, and this one I'm really excited to talk about, because I have seen this trend popping up so many times. The next point is that dads need to be aware of what we've decided to call the communication transition. And this is something that, like, everybody knows about, but I really want to just dissect it for you and help you understand at least what we have seen and also researched about mm-hmm. what's happening during these years. So one of the most common things that, like I said on Sunday, like, because we're trying to be so intentional, so much of their spiritual life is playing out in their families. So when we sit down in one-on-one scenarios, I'll ask them all the time, how are things going with your mom? How are things going with your dad? And try to just ask them questions, not to like find out dirt. And like we said, we're not idiots. We know when they're just like expressing their feelings, and you know, we don't believe everything that they say, but it's just to kind of help guide them in their part of those relationships. One of the most common things that I hear from girls regarding their fathers is something to the tune of, I don't know, we used to be close, but I don't really feel like I have much of a relationship with my dad. Generally, across the board, that's what I'm hearing.
And like across the board, she means like probably 99% of the students in our ministry.
It's rare when I hear a student that's like, yeah, me and my dad are really close. You know, it seems to be just kind of like a rare thing for girls. And again, that's their feeling. Not necessarily representing what the dad is. Because my next thing I was going to say, I hear this when I know for a fact that their dad is someone who's prioritizing family and who is involved in their life and attending things that are important to them. So, like, what is happening? Because if dad's trying to do his part and the daughter's trying to, like, you know, she's young, but she feels like she's doing her part to be available and to, you know, be open, where is this disconnect? Why does daughter feel like, yeah, I don't really have a relationship with my dad? If you feel, first of all, like this is at all sounds familiar, or this is like your relationship with your kid or ever has been, you're in really good company. Because like Bob said, this is most parent-child relationships at some point. So this is not like a rare thing. It's not just you. This is like pretty much everybody. Unfortunately, most of these relationships kind of tend to stay like that until like pretty much forever, or until the child like matures to the point that they can start to initiate, you know, like so they can start to sort of like reciprocate relationship. Yeah. As I like help students process through this kind of feeling, three things become pretty evident really quickly. First, this distancing kind of thing that happens starts at some point in middle school. By the time that they're in high school, like I would say like a sophomore in high school, they're able to definitively say, I don't feel like dad and I have a relationship. When they're in middle school, it's still kind of like a vague feeling. So that leads me to assume that this is something that's happening mostly in the middle school years, where this is transitioning, this distancing is occurring. Second thing is that most of them feel like they used to be close. And again, these are middle schoolers that are saying this, so used to be is like when I was in elementary school, when I was like 6 or 7 or 8. That's when I felt close to dad. And the third thing, the daughter generally feels like dad doesn't know how to talk to her. And I think that these are really interesting, like, common threads through all of these students' feelings, because they reveal a common cause for the distance and a common fix. So first, most of the students feel like they used to be close with dad when they were little, and now they're not. And what that tells me is that basically we all know it. And like, I can look at Bob and myself. Interacting with our toddlers, to some extent, is not like brain surgery. It's kind of easy. Like, you know, kid comes home from school or they come in and you ask, like, what'd you play with today? What'd you do? Did you make that? That's beautiful. And, like, what'd you have for lunch? And then you, like, wrestle with them and you tickle them and you kiss them and tuck them into bed and say their prayers. And, yes, relationship. And they respond to that with affection. And, like, it's like, this is working. Like, that's why a lot of dads feel like, with my little kids, we have relationship. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that at some point in the middle school years, your kids are going through a massive rewriting, like a biological rewriting in their brain. And Bob's going to expound on that in a little bit. But what happens, a big implication of this biological transition that they're going through is that I think a lot of parents miss, is that your child stops responding positively to childlike communication. And they start being more interested and like needing grown-up kind of interaction. But it's like, it's a headache for parents because this happens without any warning. They don't know it's happening. They can't be like, Mom and Dad, it's happened. I'm ready to be an adult. Like, they don't know. And they can't initiate. If they do become aware, like, I wish that Mom and Dad would, like, stop talking to me like I'm 5. If they do become aware of that, they don't know how to talk like a grown-up. They don't know how to initiate it. They lack the skills. They're ready for it. It's what they need, but they don't know how. So this typically results in children feeling like their parents don't know how to talk to them and, like, they don't understand me. And parents being, like, bewildered and frustrated as to why their efforts to connect aren't yielding relationship anymore. So what do you do?
It just spirals. You know what I mean? It's just, like, they're not... It goes from this, like, vague feeling of, like, what happened to this, like, they don't know me anymore and, like, where's my daughter? You know, it just kind of turns into this huge mess if there's not a change.
Right. So the most significant area of the relationship that's affected by this transition is verbal communication. Mm-hmm. Pretty much a lot of the other stuff, the hugging and the tickling and like that kind of, those kind of interactions, the tucking in at night, that's good and should probably stay. It's really the communication part that needs adjusted. during this period. Boiled down, begin to talk to them like you would talk to an adult. And what do I mean by adult communication? I think that the hallmark of like the way that adults, grown-ups interact is that it's a give and take. It's back and forth. And the objective is I learn about you, you learn about me. With little kids, nobody, like if you come home and you have like a five-year-old and you say like, how was your day? What did you do? Did you have fun? You don't expect them to respond with like, Dad, do you like what you're doing at work today? Did you have any meaningful conversations? Like nobody expects that from like a little kid. But we continue, I think a lot of parents continue to just give that like, I'll ask you questions. And they're ready to learn about you. That's the thing. Your kids are now ready to learn about you. They are ready to know about you, but they're not ready to let you know that that's what they need. So it's like this, oh, it's a headache for parents. So really, your objective is to be the one to update your relationship and bring it into this new level, to like adjust it for the new transition that they've gone through. Yeah. You start the change. In practice, what this really looks like is transition the interview-style communication of childhood to a back-and-forth dialogue. And so like not only am I going to ask you about your day and how things are going for you and like, you know, how's the things going with your friends or whatever, which usually is like a bombardment. That students are so sick of that. They communicate that to us pretty often. That like, oh, it's just like as soon as I come from school, they're just like asking me all these questions. It's like, stop. Like that's like what we hear a lot. So that is, it's really parents need to kind of stop that like interview kind of thing. And they're notoriously bad at this.
Anybody here feel like they don't like that? the all the questions, it's just like, what is this? Yeah.
And parents, and like moms in particular, I hear a lot, are so desperate for their kids to like share and open up and like share what's going on in their mind. It's like all of a sudden they just kind of close off. But what we don't see is parents demonstrating that and giving that in return or even first. So your kids need you to show them how to be open and how to share what's going on by you doing that, literally starting the conversation with what's going on with you. They're not going to ask you, and they might look completely disinterested, but that's what they need.
There's a couple phrases that parents say that like we see as like maybe identifying there's a little bit of a problem, and one of them is when I hear parents say, I literally cringe when I hear parents say, I tell them I'm here to talk whenever they want. And like that is something that I hear all the time, and I think that the parents have come to believe that that's like a good strategy. Like I tell my kids, like, hey, whenever you want to talk, just come and talk to me. That doesn't happen. That's like really backwards. And what you're doing is reinforcing a wrong way of communication, because it's not like I'm just going to be here passively waiting for you to make the big and hard step to come and talk to me. You know, the parent should be the one that's like engaging with that right away, you know. Continue. I don't want to. Sorry.
So what do you talk about if you're going to go into like, okay, it's like, all right, I'm going to open up and share with my child. What are you actually going to talk about? Well, you talk about you. You can. I remember like.
Well, and this doesn't have to. I mean, like that same question. If this is not something, it doesn't have to start then. I mean, if this hasn't been happening, you just pick it up and start doing it.
Right. You just start doing it. Like the next opportunity you have, you can talk about your past. I can think of a situation last year where a student was like, I feel like my dad hasn't told me anything about his past or like his childhood. And she said, and this is like a seventh grader telling me this, she was like, I feel like he probably did some stuff that he's like embarrassed to tell me about. So like she's picking up on the fact that like there's like a dad feeling like, oh, she's like not ready to hear about that. You know what I mean? Your kids need to know you. And you can like censor what you give them, but they need to know you.
Because in that case specifically, what happened was her view of her dad went down without there being any lessons learned. Let's say there was a lot of stuff in his past that was bad. Well, she got the impression that there was, which hurt her relationship with him, but she didn't learn anything by him saying, this is what I did, and this is how it messed me up. You know, so there was no lesson learned, the consequence of shielding her from his behavior as a kid was loss of relationship.
My dad doesn't want to talk to me is what she felt like, and Yeah. So talk about your past. Talk about, like, did I ever tell you the time that Grandpa and I did this, you know? Or, like, you know, like, share just stories about your past. I remember finding those kinds of things intensely interesting, and I'm sure that my face was like, but inside I was like, this is really cool to know, you know? Like, that they need to know about your history and your past and all of that. It may be, like, weeks or months or maybe even years until they start to know how to reciprocate or show that they're, like, enjoying this kind of interaction. But you're the one that is creating a context for whatever point they're ready to, like, be like, okay, I get how to do this now. Dad has taught me how to be open and vulnerable about myself. Mm-hmm. So now one day they'll just come out with something that they'll openly volunteer about themselves, and you will have been the one to create the structure for that to happen in.
Yeah.
And where and when can this happen? I think a lot of dads, when we talk about, like, we gotta have, like, a conversation with my kids, I should take them all on a date.
No.
If that is what you are already doing, and that's working,
that's what your wife says that you should do.
Probably not a good idea. Definitely not a good idea if you haven't been doing that already, because that's super intimidating.
It would be kind of a weird place to start.
Yeah, because you're just, like, staring each other down across the table. So it's just like a date with a girl. Like, I don't know. Well, that is how you would do a date with a girl. Okay, so that's a bad example. But but what I would suggest is find something that you are already doing, like a job or a errand that you run, and invite one of your kids into that. So, like, hey, come with me as I go here. Or, like, hey, let's go out and do this activity together. And then just start talking to them while they're out there doing something. You're engaged in an activity. This is, like, what a date would be. You're engaged in an activity, so it's not like you just are, like, silently, if conversation lulled or whatever, if you, like, fumble or whatever. And driving is so good for this to happen in, because you're, like, not staring at each other.
Yeah.
You're side by side. So that would be, like, I think the most accessible way to start having this, like, one-on-one intentional conversation time. Quick example from my life. My dad, a lot of you have met him. He was not a perfect man. One of my examples will be about how he was not a perfect father. But he did so good in so many ways. I'm so thankful for the dad that I had. And what he did this brilliantly. I'm one of 8 kids. And he managed to do this pretty much with all of us. And well, how he did it with me was, I can't remember how old I was, but my mom was, like, overwhelmed with grocery shopping and taking all of us kids. So my dad sort of took over that job to kind of help her out. And I remember, like, one day he was just like, Abby, come with me. And so we went to the store together, and, like, he just did this. Like, he grew up in that town, so there was lots to talk about, like, his childhood, and, like, oh, Grandpa and I used to go to markets there, and, like, just, like, driving and talking. And that became very, very quickly the norm. Whenever Dad went anywhere, I was just in the car. Like, okay, Dad's going somewhere, so I'm going with him. It was just, like, our time to connect. And it wasn't long, in my case, before I was, like, conversing with him. It wasn't all him. And what I think is significant about that, and now, I mean, like, I can talk to my mom for hours, but I can also talk to my dad for hours. When I was in college, I called my dad all the time to, like, talk. Because that was a relationship that he created. I was not special. I was not, like, a special young girl. I was exactly like every girl in our youth group. My dad did that for our relationship. And now we both maintain it, but he's the one that took it there. So just the example from my life.
Yeah, I mean, we hear a lot of parents say, what happened to my child? They, like, reached this point where they sort of became, like, a different person. And Abby mentioned this, and it's just, like, it helps sometimes to understand, like, what's going on in the background. And this is not puberty. It's become this idea that's, like, way blown out of proportion with physical changes. But there's a lot of social neuroscience that the results are becoming clear now, because it's been long enough. There's been enough studies done. During adolescence, so, like, we're talking middle school and high school, the human brain goes through almost a complete rewrite. It's like everything that you learn from 1 to 12 is actually relearned in 12 to 18. And that's a really important thing for understand, because a lot of parents say, we tried so hard to teach our children morality, social conduct, all these things, and then when they get to the point now, this is actually the one that will stick for life. The way that their mind forms during this time will most likely be how they stay for the rest of their lives. And that's really significant to know as parents, because it's really important to stay connected, to stay relevant as a force for behavior and training in their lives. Have any of you ever been told by someone that You just need to go toward them. Anybody ever been told that by their wife or something like that? That's kind of a phrase that we use a lot. This term, like, you need to go toward them. Dad needs to go toward their, you know, child more. And honestly, that is something that I like that phrase. They need you to stay influential in their lives. As a 14-year-old, you are doing the exact same morality training that you did when they were five. It's all over again. It's harder, but this time it doesn't take quite as long, and it lasts a lot longer. Going toward them is something that's so important for dads who want to be involved. And this honestly does sort of apply mostly just to kids, but it can also be for grandchildren and anything like that. So this one does specifically is more or less for dads. But we came up with a list of specifics because I like that. You know, like, how does this look? Some specific ways to go toward your kids that we think is important. Abby mentioned a couple of them. And the first one, and this is actually, I think, that a really crucial thing that a lot of dads miss, and that is visit your child's bedroom regularly. Like, that is not, it shouldn't be, if there's like a safe space there where dad's like not allowed or not encouraged to be, that would be really dangerous, we think. Visiting your student's bedroom is actually a really interesting, it's like a psychological way to stay involved in their lives. So we would honestly say it's a really good idea for you to visit their bedroom on a regular basis. And the second part of that, and Abby mentioned it, as long as your students are in high school, we think it's a good idea for you to be saying goodnight to them when they go to bed. Even when they're older. And it might be weird for you to do that, especially if you haven't. Just start by, like, sticking your head through the door and saying, hey, good night, love you. But that is, like, a really powerful way to assert your fatherhood. Mm-hmm. And honestly, a very accepted way. Like, it's not a known thing, but we have found that students actually really want that to happen. They wouldn't necessarily say that. They're not, like, wishing. But, like, saying goodnight is a really important thing to do. Also, going toward your kids looks like unashamedly broaching tricky subjects. Just, like, bringing up stuff. And I think a lot of dads try to do it. Feel like if the conversation is awkward or doesn't go well, then it wasn't worth it. That's not true. The best thing that a dad can do is just to be saying things like, so, you like anybody? Have any crushes? You know, like anything from sex to relationships, anything that you think that you want to know, you should ask. And don't, we say absorb the awkward, okay? If they're feeling awkward, just gather it all up and be like, what's the big deal? You know? Talking about any, like, if you're talking to your wife and you're like, yeah, I wonder about that, like, what does she do on her phone? Be like, so what do you do on your phone? Like, ask straightforward questions, not like from the side type things, just straight at it on a regular basis. And Abby mentioned a lot about talking about your past, and that obviously only reaches a point where it's like I run out of stuff to say. How many of your parents told you the same story like 20 times? Yeah. My mom does that. She's like, I don't remember telling you that. Yes, she did. So we would say the biggest area of the way that you engage with your students or anyone in your life is by talking about your present. Talk about your day. And this is where you might not feel like you have much to say, but the thing, the hard choice with being a dad is being like, what can I say about what I did today to my people? Mm-hmm. Even if it's so mundane. Here's a fun fact. Of all the students that we have experienced, we would say vastly over 50% of them don't know what their dads do for a living. They don't. They could probably say something along the lines of, he works in a factory, but like I would say, oh yeah, what do they do there? And they're like, I don't know. I mean, these are like high school students who don't know enough about their dads to know what company that their dads work for. And that's like we've had enough experience to know that, like, that's like a fact. Mm-hmm. Nearly all of them just don't know what their dads do. And I think that that's kind of sad. That just shows that there's not a lot of talking about just, like, your life. Another thing is, like, talk about what you're spending money on. Talk about the choices that you're making. When parents include their children in decisions, not, like, you know, an equal say, that would be dangerous. You know, like, let's vote. That could go badly. But I mean, like, okay, we know people who bought a house and moved without telling their kids and then just showed up and said, hey, we moved. And their high school daughter was not a fan of that. Why? Because she felt like she was treated like a child. She wanted to be involved in the decision to move. You know what I mean? And their parents were just sort of, it wasn't like, it was just kind of like, hey, we want it to be a surprise. But the accidental repercussion of that was, you treated me like a child, you know? Involvement in decisions is really important. Another one is talk about your relationship with God. And this doesn't have to be like major. Last year, we had a high school guy come and sit down with me, and he's like, and it was a really funny conversation because he's like, the weirdest thing happened last week. On the way home from senior high, my dad talked to me about what they talked about at the men's Bible study. And he's like, it was so weird. I was like, where is this coming from? We've literally never talked about that before. You're driving home, and it's like, so what'd you do in youth group? What'd you play? What was the lesson about? But never had he said anything about what happened here. And he was kind of blown away by that, and like in a good way. He's like, something good is happening in my relationship because my dad said something about God. You know? The point is, you have opportunity to say, well, we talked about this. That's it. That's all there has to be. It doesn't have to be like a huge lesson or a speech or anything. Just include them in spiritual life. I think that's really cool. And then the last one that I want to say, this is a really good way to go toward your kids, is to say trust-filled things. This one is specifically for dads. Another thing that we hear a lot, it's just like a standard stereotype of dads, I'm not going to let my daughter date till she's 35. You know? And like the idea that we all know is that we want to protect them, we want them to make right choices. But when you say those words out loud, all that is being heard by your daughter is that I don't trust her to make good choices.
Even when it's said jokingly.
Even when it's said jokingly. She's 12 and I already don't trust her. And that actually really communicates a lot when dads joke about saying mistrustful things. It's way better. It would be, wow, amazing to, before they make wrong decisions, already be saying, oh yeah, I mean, she can definitely handle herself. Even if you're not totally convinced that she is, what's the harm in saying that? All it does is support her and you.
And
you know what I mean?
Expectations.
Like if you said to your son who was about to try, like, you know, like you were talking to your friends and you were like, next year he's going to go out for the soccer team, but there's no way he's going to make it. What would that do to his confidence? It would crush it. We would never say that, but we say the same thing about dating and making good choices. Also, the same thing about driving. Like, if your students are like, you know, if you're expressing, well, I'm never going to let them get their driver's license, it's just like reinforcing the fact that you don't trust. It would be way better to teach them how to drive as you do and also say confident things. You know what I mean? That instills trust really, really good. And the last one, the saying trust-filled things, is when I say to parents, I really love having your son at youth group. He really listens well and responds, and they're like, well, you can have him. I have actually felt that way, and my kids are only 2 years old. There are times when it's just like, you can have them, at least for a while. Just take them, okay? Go to another room. You know, has anybody experienced that? Okay, but saying that out loud is a really bad idea. It's the equivalent of saying, I wish they weren't my kids, which we know would be so detrimental to say, but we'll say it as a joke. And so I would say that it would be a very wise thing to never say that again. You know what I mean? If your child is there and someone says, you know, encourages them, instead of saying, you can have them, being like, I wouldn't trade them for anything. Or I'll sell them to you for $20 million. You know, because then that's still a joke, but at least it adds, like, some value, you know what I mean? Anyway, that's, like, a really strong way that dads can go toward their kids. And the cool thing about all these things, it doesn't have to be all the time. One comment like that pays out a lot. It really does. Yeah.
Okay, the next one, new section.
Yeah.
Dads don't apologize very well. And I tried really hard to spin this and like a dad should do this, but really I want to say this in the negative tense because there I see such an unfortunate deficit in this area. Dads don't apologize very well, and I'm not trying to get on your case. there's probably enough people on your case about this. But I do think that it's an area that's pretty overlooked in the family setting. Yeah. And the consequence of neglecting frequent and specific apology in your home is enormous. Mm-hmm. Just to be clear, the problem that we see at work is not that dads are not apologizing at all, because I think that they are. The problem is that it's just not the most effective kind of apology. Usually it's at like kind of wide intervals and very vague. Things like, I'm sorry I haven't been a better father. Or, I've been going through a rough time, and I'm sorry for the way I've acted the last couple weeks. That's not bad. I would say it's a good start, but your apology could pack a way more like positive punch for your wife, for your kids, for every member of your home. Here's how I think that this would happen. Apologize often. Apologize to every individual. Individually, if possible, and be specific. Be specific. So instead of like the broad, infrequent apologies, say things like, I'm sorry I got angry and spoke that way to your mom earlier this evening. Please forgive me. I'm sorry that I allowed our family to get into some bad habits. Here's some things that I really wanted us to change as a family. I'm sorry that I lost my temper and said some things that I didn't mean. And I'm talking about like the day that it happens, or like as soon as you are at that point, go and say that to every one of your kids, to your wife, to every person in your home. Often, specific apology. These kinds of in the moment apologies are like beyond powerful. They will change the dynamic of your house. I know that you all know this, but I just want to quantify, like just in terms of your kids, some of the benefits that this kind of apology will give them. It will affect their understanding of God and their understanding of like their own sin based on how you treat yours. It will affect the general health of your relationship with them. It will affect the habits that they will develop and carry out in their own future families. And it affects hugely your credibility in their eyes when you give them advice or counsel or reproof. Yeah. Your apology plays an amazingly huge part in that. So I don't need to talk at length about what apologizing looks like and how that is, because I know you all know that. But what I want to do is just kind of expound on the potential good of this kind of like more frequent, more specific apology. And the best way I can do it is because I am a person who's really benefited from this in my own childhood. And I was still in high school when I realized that my dad did this well and was like, wow, I'm really thankful that he's been doing this whole time. It was like that apparent to me. There was like a couple years of my childhood where my dad fell into a really, really bad habit of like intense anger. And like, I'm talking like screaming, cursing, punching holes in the wall kind of anger often. And he would be like, you know, paying bills and someone would come needing field trip money and it would just like tip the scale and that would happen a lot and it was like scary and hard. But one thing that my dad did, and you remember, there were 8 kids and a wife. I cannot remember, and I know that maybe I'm like sugar-coating the past, but I can't remember a time where my dad did not come to me and all of my siblings individually, every time that happened, and look me in the eyes and be like, I'm so sorry that I lost my temper. Will you please forgive me? And I'd be like, oh, Dad, it's okay. And he'd be like, no, that was not okay. And he would like say it very specifically, very like intentionally and directly to us every single time. And then he would make a big show of like, getting my mom her favorite candy and like all this and like saying, but like that's not the point, but like he apologized. And what that did for me as a child was like I'm amazingly grateful that my dad did that. He was still human. That issue went on way longer than it should have in his life, but I'm proud of him that it didn't go on my whole childhood. He worked really hard to overcome his anger. But what this did for me was that at that point in my life, I did not have the spiritual maturity. I don't know that I still have the spiritual maturity at this point in my life to think, someone has just hurt me. Let me go off silently on my own and forgive them in my heart, even if they don't ask for it. Definitely, 10-year-old Abby wasn't going to do that. So what my dad did for me was every time that he transgressed against our family and against God, he gave me the opportunity for forgiveness. Where otherwise it wouldn't have occurred to me to forgive him. And we all know how that would have turned out. There would have been debris in our relationship that would just pile up and pile up until it would be an insurmountable obstacle.
Yeah.
And then we would have had to deal with it at some point, or not at all. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have a relationship with my dad. The fact that he apologized so sincerely and so frequently saved our relationship and allowed me to, like, still hear him, because he was a wise man dealing with sin. But he would, you know, when we would go on those drives and he would share insight and wisdom with me, I could still hear him and not be like, Dad's a hypocrite. You know, I had forgiven him. Yeah. So your apology affects your family so hugely. And that's the potential good of, like, mm-hmm. apologize every time you transgress. It does huge things for your home.
And we're by no means saying that that's, like, an easy thing to do, because mm-hmm. it's not. And the added benefit of getting into that habit is that it makes getting angry a lot more costly, because then you have to go through that whole process, you know. But, like, we definitely see a lot of sidelined or irrelevant fathers, specifically because of an unwillingness or just a forgetfulness to admit wrong. So that's why it would be awesome to see that happen. The last one that we want to do the tendency here that we see is that dads tend to lose motivation to remain vigilant for their children. We see a lot of dads who just over time lose motivation to remain vigilant in protecting and watching over their kids. And I think that it's easy to see, like, when you have young kids, protecting them, literally being the protector, is a very black and white thing, you know? Don't get into a strange person's van. You know, that's, like, bad, okay? Like, physical protection, emotional support, those kind of things are really black and white. They're really easy for us to understand. But as your kids get older, especially when they get into high school, protecting them just becomes so vague and much harder. Like, how do we guard our children's moral selves when they're basically adults? What does that look like? It becomes either so vague, or the other thing is that it just becomes very unwanted. A lot of you guys, your children strongly express that they don't need your help, or they don't want your protection. That is a really difficult thing to deal with. It just becomes plain unwanted, and we see what happens is that over time, dads disconnect from what is actually happening in their children's lives to the point where they are unaware, or when something bad happens, it's like blindsided by, like, how could this have happened? Because they haven't stayed vigilant in watching over their children as they get older. And I deal with, let's say, an average of maybe 6 parents a year who are sitting with me saying, my daughter, I just found a condom in her 13-year-old purse. How could this have happened? And I have to say, a lot of times it's like, we saw it coming. Where were you? And I don't mean that that's the reality. I think that it's really important for dads to remain vigilant in watching over what's going on in their kids' lives. And we just kind of wanted to take this opportunity, not that you don't know any of this, but just to give you our perspective on what is actually happening, okay? The reality is that your child is saturated by sin. Just saturated. Way more than you maybe realize. And this looks in a couple areas, and we see kind of behind the scenes of this sometimes. The first thing is basically in two ways, sexuality and pornography. We hear about the sex on the middle school Washington, D.C. trip. And we hear about I don't even really want to give examples. My purpose is not to scare you necessarily, but to give a reminder that your child is literally drowning in a world full of sin. And we sometimes lose focus of this. And this is not just for people that are in public school, although that is way, way worse. This is peer pressure to be sexually active, sexually active in middle school and high school, is one of the things that we see increasing, like, so much, probably faster than any other form of sin, is literally peer pressure among guys and girls to appear. So we actually have students that are lying to us about being sexually active, knowing that it's sin, because they want to seem like they're experienced, because that's just the norm. They're being driven to fit in, to actually have that experience. I mean, just some like general statistics that I think are interesting. We would say 30, and this is from a lot of research not done by us, 30% of students are sending or receiving sexually explicit text messages. Okay, so a third. 51% of male teenagers and 32% of female teenagers are involved in viewing pornography on a regular basis. Okay. And we would say that 51% of guys is really low. We would say in our youth group, I would say maybe 85% would be low. 85% of our students are involved in viewing pornography on a regular basis, and probably about 40% of the girls are involved in viewing pornography. And this is a huge and widespread thing, and it's just really important to be aware of. And the thing that we see a lot is that moms have a tendency to sort of like ask us, what do we do about this? But dad seems to be like not necessarily really knowing what's going on. The average first exposure of young boys to pornography is 12 years old. And we also see that 75% of adolescents hide their online activity from their parents. Whether it's sexually explicit or not, they start out at a young age learning and practicing how to hide their internet activity from their parents. That's just like creating this mode, this anonymity to sin a lot later on. Okay, so sexuality and pornography is just a really big deal, and it's not just it's not just in students, but we see this as a huge factor. That parents seem to be aware of, more aware than they are. And the second thing is social influences are such a big deal. I said about that whole adolescent brain rewrite thing. Neurologically, we relearn all of our social influences over again in adolescence. And there was a study done in 1997, in 2001, and 2013, and they all, nationwide surveys, all came up with the same base of data, and that for an adolescent person, for anyone, there's four areas that provide the foundation of our social influence. Okay, the four main areas, it's about split in 25% as to how much influence this has over us. And they're in this order, okay? Family, peers, chosen teachers, and social and media, specifically social media. Okay, so we have family is 25% of the influence that your student has. Peers are 25% influence. Chosen teachers, for instance, like a coach, or literally the study says youth leaders, is 25% influence, and social media and media is 25% influence. All these areas are so crucial, and what we see even among church people is a lot of parents focusing so much on trying to make their family, their home, and a positive social influence on their students, and that is obviously so important. But if you do your home perfectly and you neglect the other three categories, that's only 25% success. There has to be a more rounded, you have to be involved in more than just your child's family life. It's so crucial for you to be involved in their decision for their peers, actively involved in their decision of who they hang out with. And really what it comes down to is this: who are they with the most? We see students who love God and want to know Him and want to grow, and they spend 80% of their time around unbelievers. Why? And then therefore we're not surprised when they don't follow through, because it's just exposure. That the Bible calls it fresh and salt water, and we use that one because it works really good. If you're in salt water too long, it causes corruption. The only way to combat that is to literally get into fresh water and wash. You know, being in salt water for a little while doesn't make metal just immediately go away. But without fresh water to combat that, to balance it, going to public school does destroy spiritual lives. Unless there's spiritual balance. You know, there has to be balance. If there's not balance in their peers. And one of the things that we see dads stress a lot is friendships based on mutual mutual experiences, common interest. Okay, so like you hang out with the people that you play football with. And honestly, we hear a lot about that from dads too, being like, I don't really find my community in church. Nobody's really like me. And in that way, they're not even demonstrating the fact that our relationships shouldn't be based solely or even only on what we like to do. There's more to it. And you, we would say that dads really need to be vocal and active in helping to decide who your children spend time with. Because that's 25% of, and honestly, those four categories, this study said that those four things influence who they will be for life, not just for high school. Who they will be for life is determined by those four areas while they're in middle school and high school. So you have peers, teachers, and Roy is, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that because, like, it's they and it makes sense. Chosen teachers have more influence because they choose to be there, like a coach or a youth leader. But in 2018, there was a study done across the United States in high school and college teachers. 65% of teachers identified themselves as strongly liberal, and 4% identified themselves as strongly conservative. And when asked, do you use your position of influence to try to influence the religious and political views of your students? Okay, that was the question. Do you use your position to try to influence the religious and political views of your students? And the answer was overwhelmingly yes. In fact, most of the teachers expressed that influencing religion and politics was their primary purpose for being a teacher. That you have to be aware of, okay? If your kids are in school, that is what is happening here and everywhere. That means that we have to be really watchful of where and who is teaching them. And the last one is social media. But here, maybe this is too harsh, but like here we go. This is the purpose of our lives. You guys cover the family 25%. We'll cover the peer 25% and the teacher 25%, and we'll help you cover the social media one. And that's our goal is to work together to create a sphere of influence that is saturated in godliness. And that's why we feel that our ministry is so crucial. That we try to make every single time that we get together, like, as impactful as it can possibly be, just because we see that the fresh water is so needed. You know, you want to talk a little bit about the social media one?
Sure. Did you talk about modeling? Did I miss that?
No, I didn't get there yet.
Okay. Just a couple notes
modeling.
About modeling. Just a couple thoughts to share with you about social media, particularly through what's the word I'm looking for? Devices.
Oh, yeah.
Your kids are stressed out all the time, and they will tell us that. They are just overwhelmed. Students in general are overwhelmed, like, in a different, it's a whole different game than before cell phones and internet became so accessible, because they are juggling so many social circles more than it's, like, natural, more than they were designed to handle. They've got so many different areas of socialization happening that it's overwhelming their systems. And not only that, they're also, like in the past, we would, like, go to school, and if there was, like, a hard relationship there, we'd, like, okay, it's going to be a hard day. But then we would come home and have, like, some time to step out of that. Kids today don't ever leave those kind of relationships. They're good, the toxic ones, they're all constantly there at their fingertips. When they're home, when they're laying in bed, when they're at school, they're constantly connected to mm-hmm. all of their relationships with, like, seldom a break. So it is so important, so important for parents to be setting strict rules to protect your kids, literally yeah. protect their minds, because they are stressed. And it's not natural. They don't need to be, to step away from the social circles, all of them. And I think this is so good for adults to hear that
yeah.
too. You know, we weren't meant to constantly be communicating and dealing with relationships. We were meant to step away from those sometimes.
We would yeah. say it's probably almost equally as valuable as making sure your home is a godly place. So
yeah.
that's just kind of, I know, we just want to, like, there seems to be this imbalance, which we I think we have a good handle on the family aspect, but there's maybe some neglect in the peers, in the chosen teachers, as in, like, how much does your student have a coach influencing them, and also the social media aspect.
I also just wanted to throw in, too, about social media. This is just, I just wanted to say this because I had a student last Wednesday come up to me, and she's in sixth grade, I think, and she's so confused. She's like, I don't know, I've been talking to this boy, and I like him, but I don't know what to do, and I don't know if he likes me, and I'm like asking her questions, like, you know, like, what are you saying to one another? And it like comes out that like their whole, there's this weird relationship, and this is not the first, this is very common. Their whole interaction has only happened through texting. And I said, well, would you ever talk to this boy in person? She's like, no, I would never do that. Like, and I'm like, I told her, I'm like, this is not healthy. You need to stop. This is not healthy. And the boy is in youth group. And I'm like, this is so common. Your kids are, like, having weird relationships. And they're not even romantic in nature. They're just unnatural. They're unnatural, and they lead to confusion. And your kids feeling lonely, even though they're surrounded by communication and friendship, but they're lonely because they're literally alone. And just that just like made me like, oh, this is so, it's like for me, a person who, I love that girl and all the other girls that are like just talking to boys all the time and never actually in person and are so deeply confused. And I wished in that moment that there was a parent on either end that was just aware that it was happening, because my best guess is that there's nobody that's aware that they're having this weird conversation, like relationship.
Yeah.
So maybe ask your kids about that, because chances are, for the amount that we hear about that happening, there's a lot of relationships that have never even been face-to-face. It's all just through a screen, and that's not good. That's not healthy.
And we know that. I mean, like, and this is a hard thing to say, but, like, the reality is that most of that is what they're seeing modeled in their parents' use of their technology. You know, we have this disconnect to be like, it's so damaging to have children overusing media, but then we mostly see parents also doing the same sort of overuse. It's just more constructive when you're an adult. I don't think it really is. So, like, really modeling and just, like, setting hard and fast, like, black and white rules, we see is something that parents really struggle to do because they don't want to be the bad guy. I think that when it comes to this level of influence, it's worth just being like, I don't care what you think about this. This is what's happening, you know. Such as setting parameters, like, well, some easy ones for kids is to not have your cell phone in your bedroom. Which might be kind of a hard thing if they use it as an alarm clock, but then we would say it's worth getting another alarm clock.
Yeah.
Because it's just I mean, there's a lot of, it's just funny because I'm just reading all these articles right now, so I'm not like sitting around like thinking sciencey things all the time.
But, yes,
No, I'm not. But like, they were just talking about like the people that keep their cell phone in their bedrooms, they just have a lot worse sleep patterns. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a good idea to not have your cell phone in, and then it's just like, anonymity, again, you're alone. So there's all sorts of, and it's virtually impossible to make a cell phone secure enough to not access pornography. Like, it's pretty much impossible. So we would say that, like, having a cell phone in an area where there is no one else is a bad idea until you get to the point where you can trust them. And then we would say that same regulation would become a deterrent, you know, because then if you can trust your student, then freedom is the reward, you know. Yeah.
I also would say that
crank
like
open.
Mealtime, stuff like that, like if you should, it would be a good idea, I think, to have some set times like where you protect the family time. Like I remember my parents even told me that, and probably you told Bob that, when we were dating long distance, and I was always texting Bob because it was Bob. And my dad was like, Abby, we're eating. Like, put your phone down. Like, I didn't need to have that communication because it's like, it's just rude, you know, be with the people that you're with.
Yeah.
So that would just teach good,
there's a lot of
good manners to your kids.
It's hard because, like, how much, I mean, like, we would say, the one that we see really big in high schoolers is that they go out on a date, and then they text and text and text and text and text. And texting, it is just like a force multiplier in a relationship. So we actually had like a segment of our youth group where we talked about after a first date, don't text a lot. Because it just kind of messes, like by the second date, you're already on your fifth date. And like that really has a snowballing effect. And Christian students who are trying to date right end up in these weird like, over emotional in early relationships because of just because they're texting
just
a lot.
They're communicated to that point.
And I think that parents just like literally verbalizing that, not just like put that down, it's stupid, but being like, you know what, this is gonna make things go too fast. You know,
retreat.
It's hard.
Let your kids come to retreat because it's a whole weekend when they're not allowed to.
We actually hear that pretty often, where it's just like, you know, I didn't even think about my phone all weekend. You know, and that's kind of a cool thing. But I just have a couple of points that I want to make out of this, and then we'll just, any questions. The lessons here that I think I would really want to point out in this is that as a dad, it is really important for you to be vigilant to keeping sin out of your jurisdiction. You can't control all areas, but there are some areas that you can control, and we would say that you should be thinking about this on a fairly regular basis. Is there sin in my area? God created us as guardians, specifically men, as guardians. And he said, Luke 17:1, Jesus said to his disciples, things that cause people to stumble are bound to come. But woe to the man, specifically male, woe to the man through whom they come. It would be better for him if he had a millstone tied around his neck than be thrown into the ocean than to cause one of these little ones to stumble. And so we would say that that's a pretty strongly worded, it's really important for you to be watching over your internet domain. And I mean, like, I had a high school student who's sitting down with us and being like, I so want to be pure. And I'm talking to him about it. And he's like, well, I know where my dad's stash is. And it's just like, and then when he gets caught, you know, messing around with his girlfriend, it blows up in the house. And then like, how is that balanced? You know? So it's definitely like another, like, we have to really be watching out for your own household and the access to sin that is in it. And the second one is, because that's not totally possible, and if somebody wants to sin, they will, we would say the second lesson that we would love to see dads learn is be prepared to handle the inevitable failure of your student in a godly way. And in an overview, I mean, a lot of what we do with parents is sitting down with parents in crisis mode, being like, this happened, we don't know what to do. And the first thing that I always say is that you have to have consequences and rebuke and correction that is tempered by identity encouragement. This is really what it makes it more than just like, how could you do this to us? How could you do this to us? And I just want you to remember that no matter what you do, I'll always love you. Like those words right there. If you're prepared to do that, when you catch your son looking at pornography, or he comes and confesses that to you, or in general, just as a tip for you, we would say the biggest indicator for a boy involved in pornography is like a fairly sudden lack of interest in things that you used to, and just like a general sad demeanor and like a loss of motivation. And I would say that nearly all the time that is because of sexual sin. I would love to say 100% of the time. So just like an indicator there, like totally, totally obvious. If you're like, what is happening? That's what's happening. But like when you deal with that, it's so important to say, this is so damaging and I wanted to spend way more time on this, but we just don't have time. That's like a whole nother lesson as to how to deal with that kind of stuff. But remembering to temper it with identity encouragement with sons and daughters. In that moment where you're like, I'm so mad at you. How could you do this to us? And I just want you to know right now that I will always love you no matter what you do. You know, that's really important. Right now, I'm totally ticked off, and you're done forever. But I love you more than you will ever change. And that really is what makes parents and students become allies, even in those hard situations. So be prepared to handle those failures. And the last one is just, we talked about a lot of this already, but be physically and verbally involved in the moral concerns of your children. We run into a lot of people who say, you know, like a more abstract version of parenting is good. Like, you know, we give our children kind of a space to sort of make up their own mind and see the consequences of their own actions. Same study, again, this is a quote from that neurological study that we were talking about with the influence of on students. Authoritative parenting, which is characterized by frequent involvement and supervision, is associated with higher levels of adolescent academic competence, stable social orientation, and lower delinquency compared to any other parenting style. So basically it says this, being an authoritative parent, which is characterized by frequent involvement and supervision, leads to better, smarter kids, more socially stable, and less sinful. And that's like a worldly study telling us that. It's really good for you to be actively involved in your children's lives. And we would say, in those things, what dads need to do is say the why. You're not allowed to have your cell phone in your room. This is why. Not because I said so anymore after the age of like six. It's like, this is why. Okay. Always expressing the why we do things is really important. And modeling for them friendships. The fact that you're here tonight is a real testament to your kids, more than you realize, okay? Commitment. Last year we had a junior high girl express to us that in the course of just talking, she was like, yeah, every morning I come down and I see my dad having his quiet time on my way out to school. And we're like, and all the other, it was like this whole feeling of like, whoa, that's awesome. That is a, you know, your dad, your children seeing you read the Bible is something that's really impactful on them on a regular basis, you know. And just practicing that open communication, like if dad, if your kids know you, then you have influence over them. If they don't know you, then you're just some random older person who they don't understand, you know. So I would just say stay motivated to remain vigilant in the spiritual lives of your children. Be involved, actively involved. The end. So I know that was just like, so we basically have, what did we say the first one was? I forget them already. Oh yeah, encourage effectively, remember that communication transition, apologize, and stay vigilant in their spiritual lives. Anybody have any questions about this or anything? Yeah, the best ones you have to pay for. So I recommend to people this website called Covenant Eyes, which is, the thing is that there is no blocker that works good. So the best way to do it is to just monitor. So Covenant Eyes is a website that probably, it costs about $11 a month. And what it does is that you can install it on all your devices, most Android phones, and what happens is that it just, so basically you have all your devices connecting to a satellite, and it's just like a monitor that goes between them. So everything that goes through is just recorded, and then you get a report sent to your computer that says what happened when on what device. And the great thing about this is that it encourages conversation. That's the whole purpose, is to be like, so this is what I saw, or how are you doing? So Covenant Eyes is definitely, and I don't know if there's a way to get around it, but the idea is that they still have access to what they want to do. You just, it's just like, so they would say most sexual sin is like a three-footed stool. If you take away anonymity, it's really hard to keep it up, you know. Access is still there. That's another one. You can't take away access. And it is an industry, so we can't really do anything about that. It's going to still be there. Mm-hmm. So if you take away the anonymity, then the whole thing kind of falls apart. Yeah.
Would you say there's pretty much no way to prevent exposure?
There is no way. And we would say, like, it's just the expression of lust in the world is that your students are learning to apologize, to move past it, to forgive, to overcome the negative influences of that sin. And I'm not sure if it's possible to grow up and not get involved in that. I don't know. I mean, I hope that it is. But it's more about, like we would say there, oh, this is like a whole nother lesson. I literally have a whole lesson about what accountability is, because it's not just, don't do it, because it's bad and it'll destroy your relationships. That's half of it. The other half is what we call the sweeter song. It's what it's when you, as a parent...
Nutshell.
Okay, so the sweeter song is like, if you don't, this is what you get that's good. You know, and with both, and there's so many examples of this. So the one is the ropes. You're literally tied down so you can't sin and the when you want to. And the other one is, imagine the freedom of true sexuality. You know, imagine a life free of guilt, because that's the biggest one, especially that believers carry around because of hidden sin, is this second you develops. You can be free of that. You know, that's the sweeter song. You don't have to be ashamed, literally, all the time. And that's what we see. So that's like the two kinds of accountability that always have to work hand in hand. And now you guys are going to be like, Oh, we've heard this when I teach that in church, because I really want to talk about it.
You didn't talk about the Greek story that it comes
from. No.
So.
All sorts of Greek mythology that makes
really
me
cool.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is the right question.
Yeah. Yeah.
The more they're going to want to do it.
Yeah, that is a really good question, Josh, and I don't know if I have the real answer for that as far as like what we often think is like, okay, we know that there's probably, I can think of maybe three boys in our youth group who probably haven't gotten involved in that yet. And when I say pornography, I can see from their face that they don't know what that is. So what do we do with that? Like, how much do you say, hey guys, this is dangerous, without saying, what's dangerous? I think that we have always come down on the side of it is better to risk it than to have someone else say it.
And he usually, whenever he talks about that in youth group, where there is that like, oh, like some of these guys, this is like maybe the first time they're hearing that word, he usually says, like, if I'm telling you right now that this is a deadly, deadly, dangerous thing, and you choose to go and like check it out,
right,
that's a very foolish thing.
Nobody's saying, well, we're not going to talk about heroin until they're old enough to know. You know, because maybe they'll want to go do it when you're like, it causes brain damage and so many people die. You know, it's the same thing. So I think that it's better to talk about it in a vague way as far as the first thing is to just talk. It's just constantly reinforcing the value of positive sexuality. You know, and that happens through just like physical affection with your wife in front of your kids. Like, that's actually positive reinforcement and, like, a sweeter song. Because they can see that, and they can see that it's good, you know? Don't take that too far. Be weird. But, yeah, I think that we have really debated on that a lot, because I don't want to be exposing them to things that they're not exposed to yet. But we feel like it would be better for them to hear about it in the right way than to hear about it in the wrong way. Yeah, I would say that's kind of like a, based on your particular person, whether if you say don't do that, they're going to want it more. But I think either way, they will probably end up there. So it's better to have them know what they're getting into. You know what I mean? So like, if you're going to choose to smoke pot, or no, let's say not pot, let's say like a really damaging mental thing. So let's say heroin. If you're going to do that, then you should know ahead of time what it's going to do to you. So at least it adds some weight to that choice. You know, better than be like, well, I didn't know. I just thought it was a normal thing, you know. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, good question. That's something that we definitely have spent a lot of time debating on, like, where's that line of exposure? Yeah, anything else? We done? We done.